And we're going to pick up, and we didn't stop here, we stopped a couple beyond that, but we're going to look at that again, because remember I said this was a painless oral lesion kind of thing, and talking about oral cancer. And that it might present a slightly different way, but usually with some hardness around the edges, but painless and usually not cause for concern by the person themselves. And then we went to this slide, which talked about the management of it. And what I mean by management is the medical management or the treatment of this. And of course, the first thing here is, well, it depends. It varies depending on the nature of the lesion and the placement of the lesion and whether or not this lesion has metastasized and moved into other areas. So when a lesion of any type, but we're talking oral, is discovered, in order to know if the cells in it are malignant or non-malignant, a biopsy must be done. So that is going to be done in order to confirm what type of cells are growing there. And then with that, after that, the next step before they decide on any treatment is to say, has this spread beyond the boundary of this lesion? So there will be scans done, bone scans. They may take a biopsy from a close-by lymph node. And there are a variety of different tests depending on the situation that they can do. But all of those diagnostic-type tests are to get a picture of just how far this particular problem has spread beyond the boundary. Because then knowing that is what helps them decide on the best form of treatment based on research and tumor boards across the country of we've got better success with this particular kind of cell when it's spread this way if we try XYZ. And they can look at different things and then present this to the person whose body this is growing in. Because of what cancer of the tongue happens to be, it has a history. It has a past, and the past is that it's aggressive and it comes back.
When they take a biopsy, it's not the same as them taking a normal biopsy with a margin and then testing the margin? Like if they take a breast biopsy, they take, like say you have like a small nodule and they take a breast biopsy. Well, they won't take just that nodule, they take a margin
Around. To see.
It tends to go into different spots, yes. So there is no margin.
Yes. It depends on how it looks and what the history of that particular kind of lesion is, has shown in the past.
More, like, I guess
because of the nature of the tissue there.
Right, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. But a lot of different malignancies, depending on where they are, they've developed over the last, say, 25 years or so, they've developed big data banks that they know what the particulars are of certain cancers, what their patterns frequently manifest as, and how they respond to certain things. And it's a trial and error thing. Year by year, these things change because the more they learn about certain kinds of growth, and the more they experiment and try this and try this, and they find out looking at records, because they have to report into these on a regular kind of basis, and they will do big evaluations every 5 years where there are big cancer boards and so forth across the country, and they say, well, you know, look at the success they've had out in the Northwest in treating this particular kind of cancer with this particular set of chemo or surgery or whatever, compared to down in Alabama where they're doing it this way, where we've all been doing it this way maybe for the last 10 years. But look at their numbers. And what are their numbers based on? They're based on how alive that person is, how many years later. Okay. They're saying, look at their numbers. Maybe we should look at this a little more carefully. And those things then start to influence the way things are treated in other parts of the country. So communication about this data is tremendously important. Nursing care, of course, is always going along with whatever the medical management of a lesion is. And it depends upon, it's going to be subject to placement of the lesion, type of intervention, and if it's been surgical intervention, that's going to determine a lot of the direction of the nursing care. These kinds of things that are mentioned here, let's go into just a little bit more. But we'll go into it in the next slide, looking at it using nursing diagnosis type of language. But we're talking about nursing care of someone with an oral type of cancer, an oral malignancy, and what might be addressed in that way. From our nursing perspective, because of the surgical treatment that may be aggressively used for oral cancers, there could very definitely be a body image disturbance. If we remember what Kim said last week about the surgery that she saw, was that for tongue cancer or was that for some? It was for tongue.
It was tongue, but it
metastasized. Right.
He had his margin got bigger.
Yes.
As he went in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And your human response to that was, oh my God. How is this person going to deal with this? So aren't we talking about body image and a terribly destructive or altered or changed body image? So with our nursing language, you look at body image disturbance related to a physical change in appearance, because our face, no matter how we're clothed or what we're doing, our faces are out there. We see one another and recognize one another that way, resulting from a disease condition, or in this case, from its treatment. Sometimes the treatment is worse than the disease, and sometimes in terms of psychological way of thinking of it. So let's look at what some of our nursing approaches might be. Certainly to verbalize, and when do you suppose a better time to verbalize regarding a condition such as this, let's say oral cancer, might be? Would it be before treatment or would it be after treatment? It would be before treatment. So that means that this person has to have information. Where are they going to get this information? They better get it from their doc. They better get it from this surgeon. And hopefully this surgeon can be straight on with them. And that's not always the easiest thing to do. Okay. Depending on what they've been able to hear and what they've been told, you might have a surgeon who has done just a class act, a real wonderful job of explaining something to someone. You may have even been there to hear parts of it. And you know this person really did a very good job. But that person heard the patient with the disease, heard the first word or so, and their mind gets so fuzzed with the anxiety. They hear the C word, and they hear these kinds of things, and they're not able then to take in the information. So if you look at point 3 here, where it says, listen to determine if the patient's needs are psychosocial or are they cognitive, perceptive. Were they able to hear? Did they know? Do they understand what's involved here? Or is this just a gut anxiety kind of thing? So determine the patient's major anxieties concerning what's going on right now. And also what's going on in their life with regard to interpersonal relationships. Like, are there support persons here? Is there family? Are there significant others? Because only when you know what kind of support system you have and how they communicate now, can you kind of recommend ways for this patient and their other pieces of their family of how they're going to interact and ways that you might suggest regarding communication here? With this kind of situation, a referral to support groups is really helpful. I forget the name of the support group with oral cancers and radical neck kinds of things. I just can't remember the name of it. But they may be very useful in helping the patient to cope with their anxieties and fears. It's always very helpful to see somebody on the other side of an event that you're getting ready to walk through and to see how they're doing. Some people see that and say, I've seen people who are diagnosed with maybe not this situation, but let's say MS or various kinds of situations and start going to a support group, and they're very early in their disease and very early in their situation, and they see people who are further down that line and becoming much more dependent in ways that frightens the new person so much, and they never go back, or at least they don't go back for 10 years. So that can be a hot and cold kind of thing, depending on where they're coming from. One of the things that referral groups do, and people who've traveled that path, is they keep sending the message that a person's worth and value to the world, to themselves, to others, is not diminished by the physical change in that body part. And that can be helpful to hear, but that can be heard. It may be another thing for it to be taken in and assimilated and believed. Because again, here we're talking about facial and appearance kind of thing, and we put great value in this community, in this country, I think probably worldwide, but particularly this country, just think of the extreme makeovers and all of this kind of thing, on physical appearance. So it is a really big thing. The patient's progress toward developing a positive self-esteem is something that the nurse has to be aware of. And providing an atmosphere of acceptance. By providing an atmosphere of acceptance and support, you give the okay to the person to express doubt, concern, changes in feelings, perhaps changes in decisions, or new questions that might come up. It's another very practical thing that we have to think about. Ineffective airway clearance related to obstruction secondary to mucus, hemorrhage, or edema. So think of this in a post-operative kind of sense, okay? Let's say the decision was made and agreed upon by the person and the family and so forth, and so surgery was the medical management approach to this lesion. Our first priority. Just like those of you who've already been in the PACU unit, you know that airway is the number one important thing. And respiratory, continuous assessment of respiratory status. So all this entire slide has to do with keeping that airway going with slightly different approaches. And nothing on there is new to any of you. We're just sort of narrowing the focus and talking about with this kind of surgical approach to an oral lesion of some kind. Keep in mind, and this is a good thing to know, malignancies of the head and neck region account for less than 5% of all cancers. And that's a good thing to know. That kind of puts it in perspective. This is not the everyday kind of thing. When we're talking about malignancies, the everyday kind of thing is at the top of the list. Prostate, lung, breast. Depends on whether you're looking at a sheet for incidence, or death rate by cancer. They will track cancers in different ways. But incidence, it's prostate for males, it's breast for women, but death rates, it's lung cancer, and that's for both genders. Less than 5% of all malignancies. Of all malignancies. These patients who are diagnosed with a lesion somewhere in this part of the body, now I'm expanding a little bit from oral cavity, but somewhere in this area, usually do not die of reoccurrence at the site of the primary growth, but rather of metastasis. Metastasis to the cervical lymph nodes in the neck, which often take place by way of the lymphatics before the primary lesion has ever even been touched or treated in any way. And that's because of the anatomy, because of the physiology, because of the connections that are there. An operation that's not done quite as much as it used to be, called a radical neck dissection, involves removal of all the cervical lymph nodes from the mandible to the clavicle, removal of the sternocleidomastoid muscle, internal jugular vein, and the spinal accessory muscle. Now, when you hear that, don't you shudder? You absolutely shudder. This feels and sounds like massive destructive surgery. Yeah. A modified radical neck dissection is a surgical approach that's used more often because of the devastation of that kind of taking away. And by definition, modified preserves one or more of the non-lymphatic structures. They also include in that reconstructive techniques that can be performed in stages with a variety of different kinds of grafts. Areas used to procure a flap of skin are extensive and might involve plastic surgery and different kinds of things. There are many varieties and many different approaches that may include grafts that are not just skin grafts, that may include muscle, that may include bone, that may include artery and vein. So we're talking very sophisticated kinds of things here. Yes?
You say for the radical neck dissection, they take out, jugular vein?
Might take a section and do some rerouting. But here's what I want you to think about. Kind of put your hands around your own neck. Okay? Get your hands up there. It's kind of a small area, say, compared to your thorax or your abdomen or your hips. Small area. Think of what's inside there. What's inside here? A lot of big stuff, right? Here you can feel what? Trachea. What's behind that trachea?
Esophagus.
If you feel your heart rate, any of you exercise and check your carotid artery. Uh-huh. What's back here? Cervical spine. Mm-hmm. And you ever get stiff necks or anything? Yeah, I got one right now. Muscle. Strong muscles. Very, very strong muscles with super attachments down here. Your neck muscles are very interlaced. This is a very, very important part of the body because it's connecting everything to the computer, right? To the brain. So to go into this part and to manipulate and deal with a serious problem is never taken lightly. So post-op assessment of this kind of patient, this type of surgical patient, includes all of these things. Of course, you do not take their temperature orally. Maintaining the airway Depending on where they are, and it's more common for them to go to one of the units after surgery than to come straight back to the floor. Let's go to a surgical ICU unit afterwards. Probably going to keep that endotracheal tube in place for a longer period of time. Of course, after that comes out, the airway goes in. If they don't have a trach, they may have had to do a tracheostomy. You see, with the tightness and the smallness of this area and the amount of manipulation that needs to be done, how does the body respond to trauma? Surgical is planned trauma. Inflammation, right? That inflammatory response, which is a normal response to irritation or trauma. Inflammation means extra fluids, and it means edema or swelling up, right? So that can compromise the airway. So it is not uncommon that there would be a tracheostomy here with a tube in it so that the airway is ensured. It depends on the picture, and it depends on what they have to do. But that then ensures an airway. So how you approach this is going to depend on whether or not there's a trach there or not. Of course, the Fowler's position is to assist in breathing and to assist to keep this part up there because of the swelling that can happen. This person is going to be a prime candidate for good pain control, obviously, and for anti-inflammatories. Probably going to get the injectable Toradol because to keep that inflammation down there. The Fowler's position not only facilitates breathing, but it helps to promote some comfort, increases the lymphatic and the venous drainage, facilitates swallowing, and decreases venous pressure on any skin flaps that might be in place. The suctioning or removing secretions, depending on where and how the surgery was done, must be done carefully, because there may be sutures inside that you just have to be very aware of. Coughing and deep breathing, of course, to prevent pneumonia. The immediate post-operative period is probably one of the things in assessing the airway that you need to have top in your mind, is that not only are you looking and observing, inspecting, and keeping the airway clear, you're listening. What you do not want to hear is something called stridor, S-T-R-I-D-O-R. Okay, very coarse, kind of high-pitched sound on inspiration. I can't mimic it, or I would. And you listen frequently over the trachea with your stethoscope, and you report that immediately. That means things are really swelling up in there, and the airway is decreasing, okay? So you listen for changes in sounds. So this person is going to have a great deal connected to them. Usually this kind of surgery has a lot of drains. I've seen as many as 4 and 5 small drains come out here, or Jackson Pratt's from different areas. And this is because they do not want any of the exudate that will come as a part of inflammatory process, to be collecting inside. There is no room. Right, there is no room. So you'll see different kinds of things. So these people look like they've come out of a battle, literally, afterwards. This is not my favorite kind of surgery. Can you tell? This is really not my favorite kind at all. I get like super alert here.
I remember staring at him going, I wouldn't want to wake up.
Yeah.
I really wouldn't. I wouldn't want to wake up.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine waking up and looking in the mirror. Like, I don't know if I would have wanted to wake up.
They,
I couldn't imagine, like,
yes.
Somebody telling me that and having to wake up.
Right.
And not knowing what I'm, I mean, his whole face was gone.
Yes.
His whole bottom half of his face.
And there are tales where people have woken up and said, if I had known, I would never have done this. I never would have done. Why didn't they tell me? And that's part of why consent forms now are dramatically clear on things like this, because people need to know what the possibilities are, because when a surgeon goes into certain places and they start trying to do things, they have to have permission to do the best they can in there. And their knowledge of anatomy and what they're dealing with at the time, they can't know that outside. They do as much as they possibly can with the diagnostic testing and measuring and all kinds of things. But you don't know some things till you get in there. And you are relying on that surgeon's knowledge and skill to do the best they can. But it can be a scary thing. And these people need to know. And it's very helpful for them not to be rushed on this and to really, really really be careful and know that, hey, I'm not going to go that route. I've seen people make this decision. You probably know people who've made this decision and might say things. I've seen these skinny little old men with long alcoholic histories, you know, in and out of the rooms, in and out of the AA rooms for many years, weigh about 120 pounds. A little scruffy looking, gravelly voices, smoked like bandits for 40, 50, 60 years, you know. And now they've got something. And they will use humor, and they will have things growing on them. they will say in their gravelly voices, going to live out my days this way, one way or another. You know, may go back to the drink, may do other things, or may not, but they kind of look at it philosophically. They're very interesting teachers because they've lived a life that flaunts everything in terms of healthy behavior in anybody's face. You know, this is my bod, my life, I'm going to do what I want. By golly, they do. Okay. And so here they are at age 62, whatever, and they got this thing. And some of them can be very philosophical. Hey, I did this to myself. Not blaming the doc, not blaming the wife, not, you know, that's it. Gonna go this way. And they just keep puffing and they just keep doing whatever because they know. They know. Now, whether we want to call that denial, whether we want to call it a coping mechanism, hey, that's their choice. People need to see what the options are. And the only good thing about this whole scenario is that it's a small portion of the total malignancy picture. That's the only good thing that I see. That's one of the reasons that probably kept me away from, because very early on in my student nursing days, I saw a lot of this stuff. Scared the bejeebies out of me. And boy, I never was interested in smoker. I tried it, because it was cool, but it didn't work for me. And then when I saw this, that was enough. That was just enough for me. Yeah, I know.
They're going to break you. We're going to go outside. And he'd go, please go with them. And he'd go, I remember one guy going, come over here, but don't touch anything and look in. And I was already doing it. I was already doing that operation. And she goes, so Kim, you're going to be ready? And his lung was black. Mm-hmm. And black. Mm-hmm. And
hey, I know. We are selective in how we look at things. It was the post-op part that I didn't like. It wasn't looking into the lung. It was seeing how they had to live.
See, I never saw that part.
See, and that's what did it for me. That's what did it for me. And I just, you know, fear is a very strong motivator. Oh, I know.
After doing it, you continue.
I know. It gives you an idea of the power of addiction. The power of the nicotine to get into the cells is just absolutely amazing. My own husband has gone back to cigarettes, and I thought I might kill him. I thought I might kill him when he did this. He stopped for something like 8 years. He has a brother and a sister who has died of lung cancer. And he has learned to limit it carefully because I won't live with it, so it's never in the house. It's never in the car. There are a lot of places. So you become like a, you know, yeah. I mean, it's foolish. It's foolish, and yet I understand on a knowledge-based level how that is, and I'm not gonna go there. You just make everybody's life miserable if you do that. We're all independent units. We have to make our decisions, and that's the way it is. But anyway, not my favorite kind of situations, and that's coming through. So I just need to be honest with you. Whenever we have a bias or a fear or whatever, I don't mind sharing that. Okay. We're going to go down the track a little bit and look at the esophagus here. Esophageal problems. GERD, you've all heard GERD. And, of course, that's an acronym that's aptly used because that's just too many words to say. Too many things to get off. Too many syllables to get off. But it's a reflux. Reflux of stomach contents back into the esophagus, sort of a backward flow. And that first word down there under symptoms is just a fancy word for heartburn. Pyrosis. That burning sensation behind the sternum occurs after eating or when bending over or lying down, especially on lying down on the right side. Regurgitation is the ejection of small amounts of sour gastric contents back up into the mouth. This is not vomiting, just a small regurge. Dysphagia, of course, is the difficulty swallowing. I don't think I can say the next word. Who wants to take a shot at that word? The one with the O. Hey, see? All right. Yucky word, huh? Painful swallowing. When the reflux causes an irritation or esophagitis, an irritation of the lining there. Esophagitis is that irritation. And not all people develop this. Hypersalivation is another thing we could add to this list. Chest pain is another thing that we could add to this list. Sort of a substernal, maybe radiating to the neck, to the mandible, to the shoulders, to the upper arms. When caused by reflux and not cardiac problems. But this is a scary kind of pain because the person thinks, my goodness, am I having a heart attack here? Okay. This occurs more during rest, especially if they're lying on their back in a supine position. It's usually decreased somewhat by movement, by exercise, but it has to be differentiated. And there's more than one person who's ended up in the emergency department because of chest pain like this that's radiating every place, and they're convinced they're having a heart attack, and they made what was a wise move to get checked out. And then to differentiate, are these cardiac symptoms or are these GI symptoms, is something that is the job then of the diagnostician there to separate it out. Because if it's cardiac, you're going down a whole different road. But if it's this, it's a different form of treatment. So continuing to looking at GERD. In order to definitely diagnose, they have to get some confirmation. So pH monitoring, endoscopy is the preferred way, or barium swallowing. I don't have your handouts reproduced yet for all the diagnostic testing, but I do have them with me, and I'll get them over to office services today, so you will have them on Monday, so that you don't have to write all that stuff yourself. Management of this is, from a nursing standpoint, usually this is handled on an outpatient kind of basis. So they're usually given leaflets of information on the teaching part, the patient teaching part, on what they need to do and what they can expect and how they should show up and what they can expect at the time of testing, what they're looking for. The pharmacologic approach to GERD, and we'll look at these different things, are antacids, H2 blockers, and gastric pump inhibitors. So let's take a look at the antacids. Antacids are common, over the counter. And because of that, some people can easily misuse them, misabuse. And I don't mean in a sense that's going to, not in the sense of a narcotic misuse or anything. They just don't use them correctly. But they do give some relief of pain. It is an antacid is a. Do I have this on my next slide? Primary goal of it is to relieve the pain. Let's go on to the next slide here. This person's hurting and they're looking for something. And there's a huge array in any large pharmacy, drugstore now, that has all kinds of things. Not only are the antacids over the counter, but the H2 antagonists are over the counter now. So buying them that way and using them that way can be okay, as long as they're used correctly. There's a key thing that you need to get clear about antacids, and that is that antacids in this array, we're going to look at three different groups of pharmacological approaches to this. Antacids are the only ones that neutralize. Antacids neutralize. They change the pH of the gastric contents, the gastric juice contents. So they have a neutralizing abilities, and the other two categories that we're going to look at do not. So they are unique in that way. And in doing that, they help that stomach lining increase its resistance potential. And in doing that and keeping that pH at a little bit higher level, they're able to increase the tone, the muscle tone of the esophageal sphincter, which kind of cuts down on the gastric reflux. Antacid therapy should be a very regimen kind of thing, and it can actually get a little bit pricey, because of the amount of antacid that people need to take on a regular basis. And when most people pick it up over the counter, a little Mylanta or something themselves, they don't use it in a long-term way that is as beneficial to them as it could be. Because it is an alkaline chemical agent. I don't think I've got that. Our one large doses. I've skipped a word here, haven't I? I don't know. I've just mistyped that. And I'm not sure what our one large doses. Yeah, let's do that. That makes sense. They are on large doses. It is not uncommon for a physician to prescribe this kind of therapy, antacid therapy, and that means that the doses are large and they're frequent. So one bottle of Mylanta doesn't do it. It's several bottles that they have to take. And the neutralizing ability and the ability to make the stomach contents more alkaline through the antacids can interfere with the absorption of certain drugs, such as digoxin and clopromazone and thorazine and dilantin and others. So it is a fairly common subnote that you will see on your patient's medication record that not to take within 2 hours of antacids. Don't take them at the same time because the antacid interferes with this. So this increased alkalinity can interfere with the absorption of other drugs. It also increases the urinary pH and may interfere with the elimination of drugs. So antacid therapy has some drawbacks to it. And that's why, even though it will work with large enough doses and for a long period of time, they take it several times during the day, because it interferes with other drugs and because it's a big volume thing and they have to take it so often, there's less compliance with it. So you're not finding it to be the first-line choice of physician-ordered therapies. Comes in all kinds of forms. Solutions and suspensions are better than chewable tablets, better than Tums, okay? Because they're more finely divided and they're of a more uniform nature than the chewable tablets. If a person is taking a chewable tablet, like a Tum or a Rolaid, something like that, they should drink a full glass of water to help disperse them and get a better use. I'm not saying they're bad. You just get a better job if you do it with the water. The effervescent solutions, such as Alka-Seltzer, are what are considered a systemic antacid, a systemic antacid, and they don't have the codeine kind of effect, and they are very short-term. Some of them contain aspirin that can be irritating to the stomach and consequently not good for ulcers if the person actually has an ulcerated condition. Very high in sodium. Okay for a short-term, one-term kind of thing, but not the ongoing kind of solution. Shouldn't be for the problem. Shouldn't be that. Bless you. The schedules for antacids are usually something like 1 hour after eating, and then the effect of the antacid in the body lasts for about 3 to 4 hours. There might be a little bit of food left in the stomach from eating, and with some food in the stomach, the effect of the antacid will last about 3 to 4 hours. Antacids always need to be shaken well, okay, in order to distribute the contents. And once they get it in their mouth, frequently they like to rinse their mouth out because it kind of coats the mucous membranes in the mouth too. Older thinking was that milk was good for gastric ulcers or gastric upset. But in fact, the protein and the calcium in the milk stimulates the cells to secrete more gastric acids. The treating of GERD or ulcers, I'm moving into some ulcer kind of talking now. The treatment of this with antacids can be effective, and actually the pain of the problem will recede before the healing, if it happens to be an ulcer, actually happens. In order for antacids to be effective, the acid neutralization is necessary for a long enough period of time, if it's being treated for ulcer, for it to heal properly. So I've stretched out just a little bit from GERD. Let's look at two other areas here of pharmacological approach. The H2 antagonists. They actually work right on the parietal cells of the stomach. And in doing that, they interfere with the action of histamine on those particular receptor sites. And by interacting or inhibiting the action of the histamine, it means that the amount of acid that is secreted by these cells is drastically reduced, which allows healing to go on in this area. Again, I've got the word ulcer here, but for whatever is being treated. It allows, so this is not neutralization. Don't put the word neutralization with H2 antagonist. This is an interference with a normal body response, a normal cellular response. It's getting on a receptor site of the parietal cell and means the histamine sensitive area is not able to do its thing.
It blocks.
Mm-hmm. It blocks. Okay.
What is that called?
H2 antagonists or H2 histamine 2 antagonists. Mm-hmm. We'll look at those a little bit more. This is a little fuzzy picture, but it's just showing the types of cells. Three specific zones in the stomach that have different kinds of glands. And in the parietal cells, a little more down here in the pyloric area, we have parietal cells here. I'm sorry, in the gastric or fundic glands. And these are the ones that the histamine can come from, and that is what is blocked by this medication. Continuing to look at these, the goal of using this type of drug, an H2 antagonist, is to reduce the amount of secretions. It can be used prophylactically for duodenal ulcers, where the risk for any kind of gastric or intestinal ulcers is very high. The therapeutic goal of using these kinds of medications, of course, is to reduce the acid secretion so that healing can be promoted. And you want the pain to go away. Other things that people with GERD or with any kind of ulcer disease should be told to do is to decrease smoking and decrease or avoid caffeine, because both of those things stimulate gastric acid production. If this is being used for ulcer rather than GERD, the symptoms are going to subside within a couple of weeks, but the healing goes on for up to 8 weeks. If these two things are being used together, and they are sometimes, not as frequently anymore, prescribed H2 antagonists and the antacids, both drugs working toward the same goal in slightly different ways, they need to be separated in their time of giving. Once a person has been on this type of therapy for a while, a couple of weeks, they'll decrease the dosing and get it down to just one a day, but that one will be given at nighttime to decrease gastric secretion during the night. Here are some examples of H2 antagonists. They are no longer the most popular kids on the block for this kind of treatment. Tagamet has really lost face, particularly with elderly clients and so forth, because it causes so much mental confusion. It can also lead to some temporary erectile dysfunction and impotence in men. So it's not the drug of choice. The top one, the Tagamet or cimetidine, can also increase the toxicity of many other drugs. Warfarin or the oral Coumadin, anticoagulant Coumadin, being one of them. So, and cigarette smoking can reverse the effects, therapeutic effect of cimetidine or Tagamet. So, Tagamet, which when it came out like a roaring tiger, you know, that this was greater because that person could take a couple pills a day and they didn't have to take all these antacids and it was great and everything. And boy, everybody was on its bandwagon. And then it started getting bad press. After several years, it started getting really bad press and people started backing off of that. You can get Tagamet, Zantac, and Pepcid all over the counter now. And here's the drug of choice, the types of drug of choice now. And this is what you're going to see more of in the acute care hospital setting. Proton pump inhibitors. Because this interferes with something. This is another drug that interferes with something. The H2 antagonists interfere with histamine release by blocking a certain receptor. This prevents the movement of the hydrogen ions out of the parietal cell into the stomach. So we're looking at the same kind of cell action, parietal cell, but doing a different thing to it. And in preventing the movement of the hydrogen ion out, it blocks all, please underline all, gastric acid secretion. It is a less than 8 week or a short-term therapy. It is considered for acute treatment for any many indications. You've got the list of indications there. The type of pump or the enzyme release and the energy that's necessary for a common step in the acid secretory process of the parietal cell is what's being interfered with here. And if there's energy to run this pump, it's going to release the hydrogen ions out of the parietal cell. And because those hydrogen ions are protons or positively charged substances, the pump is also called or referred to as a proton pump. There are other proton pumps in the body doing different kinds of things. But we're just talking about this one. So because of the way it works and its specificity, which is right down here in a complex situation, and because it's limited to just the action of the proton pump, it does just this one thing, which is to totally inhibit the secretion of any gastric acids. Let's look at some examples of proton pump inhibitors. That picture made it look kind of simple before. I just had it up there for a short time. But actually, there's a very involved set of steps, series of steps in this acid secretory process inside the parietal cell of the stomach. And if there is that energy that's present to run the pump, it's going to release those hydrogen ions out of the parietal cells. Back to the H2 blockers. H stands for histamine. The H2 blockers may block close to 90% of all the acid secretion. The proton pump inhibitors effectively block all acid secretions. So they are considered first-line therapy for erosive esophagitis, symptomatic GERD, and short-term treatment of active duodenal ulcers or active benign gastric ulcers. Their effects are very confined to the parietal cells. The drug that I've got listed up here, I've got two of them listed up here. The first one was Prilosec, and the second one is Prevacid. How many people in here have ever given Prevacid? Very commonly given drug. These proton pump inhibitors seem to be remarkably safe for short-term therapy. Getting back to a more of a GERD kind of approach here. A surgical approach is something called fundoplication, a wrapping a part of the gastric fundus, that part of the stomach, up around the esophageal sphincter in order to try and attempt to keep the contents in the stomach and from splashing back up or regurgitating back up. Not a first line kind of thing by any means. Hiatal hernia. The definition is here, it's when a portion of the stomach protrudes up through the esophageal opening in the diaphragm. And there's a listing of possible causes to it. Congenital weakness, pregnancy, obesity, traumatic injury, a little picture of it. Key word here is that this can be almost universal, and key word is asymptomatic. Most patients are asymptomatic. This is just a known thing. It can be visualized this way. But it may not ever present in any medical office at all as being problematic. But those who do have manifestations of this problem might have that set of symptoms that sound very similar to GERD. Heartburn, and particularly at nighttime, having some problems with dyspepsia and problems with breathing also. So hiatal hernia is extremely common. Gastritis. And gastritis is, if you look at the last four letters or the suffix of this word, I-T-I-S, and the term here is referring to inflammation of this stomach ulcer. Acute problem can be because of something that's been ingested. This type of irritation is common after various treatment approaches to malignancies because of the type of cells that line the gastrointestinal tract have very short lives and are very quickly proliferating, very quickly replacing themselves. Since they have a short life, they are the ones that are most easily affected by and wiped out to a great extent by the radiation or the chemotherapy. Those types of drugs are used for the rapidly dividing malignant cells, or cancer cells, but in doing that they also attack the, or have an effect on the hair follicle cells and the linings of the stomach and esophagus and the mouth, which is why some of the side effects of those therapies present as they do. So gastritis is a mild kind of heartburn, severe gastric to, anyway, a range of mild to severe, bleeding, possibly vomiting of blood, very uncomfortable. Treatment for acute is to treat the symptoms. And in treating the symptoms, changing a little bit of what's going in there. So this kind of person is going to be told, stay away from the Mexican restaurants and the Spanish restaurants go to more bland kind of diet. Don't do anything that stimulates more gastric juice release. Put on an antacid regime. If they have a real acute problem that's causing a lot of reflux and a lot of loss of fluids, there may be a need for some fluid or electrolyte replacement. Gastric juices are very rich in electrolytes. So if a person has a lot of reflux or a lot of vomiting going on, they can get very imbalanced in their electrolyte picture. Some of you might have heard about H. pylori. I just found my notes. Let me just blacken that for a minute. Go back to the gastritis for just a minute. Normally the stomach lining is impermeable to the acid that it secretes. It's a property that allows the stomach to contain acid and pepsin without having its own wall digested. The prostaglandins are an important factor in protecting the GI mucosa against the injurious effects of irritating agents such as gastric acid. They're not quite sure how. They just know that they are an important containment there. Drugs such as aspirin and indomethacin and other NSAIDs inhibit the production of prostaglandins, which can lead to the side effect of gastric upset in many people when they take those common drugs. Alcohol is known to disrupt the mucosal barrier, and when aspirin and alcohol are taken in combination, as they often are, there is an increased risk of gastric irritation. Gastritis is often caused by infectious organisms such as Staphylococcus endotoxins, and usually has an abrupt and violent onset with gastric distress and vomiting following the ingestion of contaminated food. So I'm talking about food poisoning here. For about 5 hours, if anybody's ever had some bad food, if you've had poison, you know that that's not a fun thing. And the body and the stomach reacts very violently to that. Okay. This is, can you read that top one? That's a hard one to read, isn't it? Good thing you got it in front of you. Infection by a particular bacteria. Bacteria Heliobacter pylori, or H. helo B, they will sometimes call it. It damages the mucosal protective mechanisms and leaves them vulnerable. Signs and symptoms are as they present here. The treatment is similar to what we've already discussed, antacids, H2 antagonists. An addition for this person may be of sulcrophate, S-U-C-R-A-L-F-A-T-E, sulcrophate. It's an oral medication that is not really systemically dispersed in the body. When it goes in, it acts almost like an internal band-aid on the part of the stomach that kind of coats it a little bit. And it's never really absorbed. This person is also treated with antibiotics to kill Helicobacter pylori bacterium. This particular kind of causation for gastritis was poo-pooed for a long time by the medical world, that peptic ulcers or any kind of gastritis or anything could be related to an infectious kind of process. But there's been enough research now around to show it that some people are more susceptible to this, and this definitely is part of the problem. And so those people do respond very well to the symptomatic treatment with either the antacids or the H2 antagonists or the sulcrophate, with the addition of antibiotics. Since I've mentioned this a lot of times, let's look at PUD, or peptic ulcer disease. Peptic ulcer disease, the name actually depends upon the location of the ulcer, whether it's in the stomach, the pylorus, the duodenum, the esophagus. There's some confusion about the terms peptic ulcer and gastric ulcer. Peptic ulcer can occur any place in the GI tract that is exposed to acid pepsin secretions, so it's a broader kind of term. There's a genetic component to this. Peptic ulcer disease occurs 2 to 3 times more frequently when there is a family history of this problem. I think we need to take a break. I've had my watch on backwards, so I wasn't reading it right. And I just turned it around and saw what it was and said, oh, I think maybe we better do that. You need a break.